When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, daters. Are you sick of small talk and no date being planned? Well, I'm excited to introduce you to First Rounds on Me, a revolutionary dating app designed for modern singles who are fed up with the frustrations of today's dating scene. The app is all about actually helping you plan dates and build genuine connections. How so? Well, the only way you match with someone is by planning a date. Send a date, a time, and a location, and then the rest is up to you. Ready to go on real dates? You can get 1 free month of their premium subscription with code DOCTOR, D-O-C-T-O-R. Download First Rounds on Me using the link in the show notes and start building meaningful connections offline. Hello and welcome to Reimagining Love. I'm Dr. Alexandra Solomon. Relationships have the power to wound us and the power to heal us. As a clinical psychologist, author, and professor at Northwestern University, I've devoted my life to studying intimate partnerships and family dynamics. On Reimagining Love, I'm here to translate complex clinical topics into tools and takeaways that you can use in your relationships today. If you're ready to develop relational self-awareness and create vibrant and loving relationships with the people who matter most to you, you've come to the right place. I'm so glad that you're here. Welcome back to Reimagining Love. What would change if, instead of prioritizing romantic relationships, we made friendships the center of our lives? That's the question that we are tackling today with my guest, Raina Cohen. Raina is an award-winning producer and editor for NPR's documentary podcast, Embedded. Her work, often focused on social connection, has aired on numerous podcasts and radio shows, including Hidden Brain, Invisibilia, and All Things Considered. And her writing has appeared in The Atlantic, The Washington Post, The New Republic, among others. Cohen is a graduate of Northwestern University, Go Wildcats, and Oxford, where she was a Marshall Scholar. And she's the recipient of a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Humanities. And today, Raina is here to discuss her new book, The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. Through years of original reporting and social science research, Raina invites us into the lives of people who prioritize deep friendship. These are friends who share homes and parenting responsibilities and care for each other throughout their lives. In doing so, they defy conventions and challenge our assumptions about which relationships are most important. Through this exploration, Raina argues that we undermine romantic relationships by expecting too much of them, while we diminish the value of friendships by not expecting enough of them. To me, this topic embodies the title of this podcast, Reimagining Love. Raina and her subjects invite us to reimagine what possibilities our friendships hold. I found Raina and her book to be delightfully heady and heartfelt, and I fell immediately in love with her work. I hope you will too. Raina, thank you for taking the time to be here with me today.
I'm so excited to talk.
You know, this is a very well-timed conversation because last night at 8 p.m., I landed back in Chicago after having spent a long weekend with my best friend of 40 and one half years. So I am fresh off of a deep dive into my own most treasured friendship on earth. So I'm ready to talk friendship with you.
And I'm guessing you guys met at a very young age because you're counting the half year.
Yes, we met when we were 10. Fifth grade,
Yeah, fifth grade.
Well, I'm glad that you are coming in, thinking about and really appreciating the importance of friendships.
Absolutely. So before we dive into your really, truly smart and insightful and like unique, as I was reading your book, I was like, oh my gosh, this is the book we've needed. I didn't even know we needed this book. And then here it is. So I cannot wait to talk about the other significant others. But before we get to that, I want to ask you the question that we ask all of our guests here on Reimagining Love. So you ready?
I'm ready. Yeah. Throw it at me.
Okay, Rena. How are you reimagining love in one of your important relationships these days?
So I think I'm reimagining love by thinking a little bit differently about how the relationships that are closest to me in my life are going to structure what my life looks like. I'm married. I'm calling you from my house, and I live not only with my husband, but with two of my close friends and their two kids. And actually, behind me is the ketubah from my wedding, which one of the friends in this house signed because she was our officiant. And then in the room next to me, there is another ketubah that's for the friends who I live with. And ketubah is a kind of traditional Jewish marriage contract. So instead of kind of assuming that a romantic partner is the only person I'm going to live with, I've sort of expanded outward from that, along with the shared desire of my husband to really integrate friends into our life.
I was really grateful that you shared the journey of how you and your husband made the decision to create a home with this other couple, and how even though by that point you were well immersed in this book where you are exploring how to center friendship, even the process of you and your husband deciding to create a home with this other couple highlighted for you some of the challenges and some of the assumptions that you hadn't quite excavated for yourself. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, my husband and I have been talking about living with friends for a while, but specifically we got into a conversation about buying a home. We felt like we had, you know, been working toward a down payment. And when we ended up in a conversation with these two friends, it seemed like what would be necessary is to rent rather than buy, and that renting a home would be more expensive than the very cheap rental that my husband and I had been sharing as just the two of us. So I had kind of like unwittingly bought into this idea that there are these markers of adulthood and that you should prioritize something like finances and, you know, owning a home over other kinds of relationships. And I, you know, remember being on a hike with my husband as we talked about this and being excited about living with these friends, but also thinking about the kind of practical costs. And his response was like, do either of us really care about buying a home? Is like, is that the most important thing to us? Or is that just basically the default next step that we thought would be nice and made sense? But like, don't we care about community more, essentially? So we had a really open conversation about what is it that we value? And then can we use those values to determine how we organize our lives? And I mean, it felt embarrassing to me that he had to ask me, like, do we actually care about buying a home? Do you care about this? Because I, you know, was writing a whole book about people who, one, really prioritized friendship, but more broadly, were really questioning the defaults that we have been handed about what our relationship should look like and what a good adult life looks like. So I needed to have that question come from somebody else in order to get to a place where I'm like, oh, of course, like these friends are exactly who we want to live with. They're, you know, wonderful hosts. It will change our experience of life to live with them. My husband loves children. So like living with the now two kids, you know, was especially exciting for him. So that was a little bit of the path to getting here that took some rethinking of my own expectations along the way.
I think it's really important that you name that there was like a little bit of embarrassment that came up for you when he was the one to highlight. But listen, let's really like zoom out and look at our priorities and our values. And then from that place, figure out our decision-making process. Because I had a similar, I mean, I had many, many moments of embarrassment reading your book because you really are challenging us to look at assumptions. And the thing about assumptions is they are assumptions. They are relatively invisible. They feel like capital T truth. And as I was saying to you before we started recording, I take a lot of pride when I'm working especially especially with my undergrads or even on the Reimagining Love show, to always be like pulling forward an assumption and shining a light on it and asking questions about what is the root of this assumption? Who does it serve? What are the power structures that created this assumption? What are we missing when this assumption is in the driver's seat? And I was so struck again and again in the journey of your book, how you highlight assumptions around the role of friendship in the larger matrix of a life and a good life. So I'm so glad to hear that you still have work to do. I think it just highlights how embedded this all is, like how much we are taught that, you know, owning a home is a top priority. Marriage is a top priority. Like romantic relationship is the center piece of life, you know, and all these kind of ideas that just are assumptions.
Absolutely. And it really took not just talking to people who had these friendships, but also people who had no choice but to come up and question these assumptions, like including people who are asexual, for example, mm-hmm. and are questioning, like, how do we define what partnership is and what is the role of sex? And, you know, people who have more than two parents in a family or raising their kids with friends, that their lives ended up forcing a lot of these assumptions to sort of come out of the woodwork, which we usually don't have an opportunity to question.
Yeah. Okay, so let's back up. This new book of yours is called The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. And it's a celebration and an exploration of what you describe as profound friendships. It's part history, it's part anthropological study, it's part autobiography, and exploring this history of what you refer to as platonic partnerships and telling the stories, as you're saying, of people who have made friendship the center of their lives and giving us a chance to look at what happens when you build a life with friendship at the centerpiece. And it starts with you telling the story of this profound friendship that you experienced with M. So can you start by telling us about the friendship with M and then the questions that emerged for you because of the discovery of this new type of relationship in your life?
So not long after I moved to DC, which is where I've lived for quite a few years now, I ended up meeting M at a mutual friend's birthday party and was just struck by her even before we'd gotten a chance to talk. I, you know, saw her across the room and saw how engaged people were laughing with her. And we got into conversation. We soon realized that we lived a 5-minute walk away from each other. And in addition to just sort of clicking in that first interaction, it became so easy for us because we live nearby to see each other a ton. We would see each other 4 or 5 times a week, and we're just very quickly integrated into each other's lives. Like I would stop at her house on the way to the metro in the morning and we would just kind of catch up and have breakfast together. Or, you know, I would come by and we would just read together in silence. We were plus ones to each other's office parties. We had a shared friend group. So with all of this, it just felt like we had gotten to a place where even the term best friend didn't really cut it to describe who we were to each other. And we spent some time thinking about, like, how do we talk about who the other person is? And we thought about partner. And, you know, part of the context here is that I was in a relationship at this point with my now husband, had been for something like 2 years at the point at which I met M. So one of the things that came up for me was that the feelings in this friendship did not seem that fundamentally different from what I felt with my now husband. It just didn't have a sexual component. So I became really interested in trying to understand what this kind of friendship was and why we didn't have a name for it, what we might learn from people who had a similar kind of friendship. I knew a little bit about the history of very intimate same-sex friendships and how they'd fallen out of favor. So I had some sense that there was a precedent for this and we had lost some different kind of way of understanding friendship. And that's kind of how I set out to find people who had these sorts of friendships today and what we could learn from them.
What do you think it says that you couldn't even, like when you set out on this journey, you really couldn't even find a definition or a term to capture this quality of friendship? What's telling to you about that?
I think it says that we have these limitations on what friendship can be. The absence of a term is an indication that we as a society don't understand that it's possible for a friendship to be so devoted that it rises to the level of partnership.
Is there a little collusion going on there? Like where if we don't have the term, then we really can't do this thing that you're inviting us to do, which is explore the possibility of centering friendship, you know, building a life that centers friendship. It's like, if there's no term for it, it really can't be a legit pathway. So I wonder if there's a little bit of like a kind of recursiveness, you know, the more we don't see it, the more we don't imagine it, but maybe there's something kind of helpful about imagining it. Because the more we imagine it, the more I think the idea is that it would threaten nuclear family as the centerpiece. It would threaten romantic relationship as the centerpiece. Is that, am I being paranoid that there's maybe a little bit of kind of convenience here that we don't have a term?
Well, I think there's certainly the recursive quality that you're talking about. You know, I don't know how much people are, you know, consciously trying to push down friendship and stick it in a box. Certainly, if this sort of friendship is out in front of people, like, for instance, with Oprah and Gayle King, that there is this constant suspicion that the two of them can't really be friends. There's a lot to unpack there, but I think most of the time, it is not even occurring to people that a friendship could be this way, and that it would change people's possibilities for their lives if they knew it could happen. But what I think is so interesting is that I found a lot of people who have this friendship despite us having no name for it.
Right.
Which I think speaks to how capable we are of having this in the face of so much resistance and no support, no societal support, no legal support, that people form these friendships nevertheless. And one of the kind of sadder or more poignant things that came from all these conversations with friends is that they did not realize there were other people like them often. They kind of thought they were going it alone. One of the requests from a pair of men that I interviewed was they wanted to be put in touch with other people, older people who had this kind of friendship. They wanted elders who had gone through the same thing as they had, but you know, they felt like they didn't have anybody really to turn to show them what it would be like for the long haul.
Mm-hmm. How did you find these platonic partners?
Well, I will say it's a bit challenging to find people who have a relationship that has no name and is socially invisible. There is no association for American platonic partners. So I did a lot of describing to people what I was looking for, and occasionally people knew someone in their life. But what ended up being quite effective, and I only realized in retrospect, was figuring out like what would be a community where this kind of friendship might be more likely to happen, like in an asexual community, because people are not necessarily desirous of or in a position to have a kind of conventional romantic relationship. There are all sorts of ways people have conceived of how to find partnership or how to find support. So I was able to get in touch with people in the ace community in New York, or I write about a pair of men, one of whom is gay and celibate, and there's a whole gay celibate Christian movement. And so I got plugged into them. When I was traveling in the Midwest one time, I emailed some senior centers and described what I was looking for. And a couple of them got back to me saying like, I know exactly what you're talking about. And here are these people. So there was a bit of like, just trying to tap into communities where there might be a person who knows other people well enough to say like, hey, I know what you're looking for. The other kind of main ways that I wrote a piece for The Atlantic a few years ago as I was developing the idea for the book, and I got some responses to that came from people who had this kind of really devoted friendship, and I was able to find people that way. But it is something that seems in many ways pervasive, but also really hard to find.
Do you feel like you're at a crossroads in your love life? Maybe you are sick of modern dating or wondering if the person that you're with is your person. Whatever your situation, I have the perfect podcast for you, Dateable. Dateable is your insider's look into modern dating, hosted by Julie Krafcik and Yue Xu. Julie and Yue bring a sense of humor to their insightful explorations of all things dating, turning matches into actual dates, the psychology of relationships, red flags, attachment styles, and so much more. I am proud to have been a guest on their podcast 3 times. So if you're looking for a great starting point, check out my latest episode with them, When You're Ready and They're Not. I'll put a link at the bottom of the show notes. Wherever you start, this podcast is going to help you feel inspired to date differently and create a love life that works for you. Subscribe to Dateable wherever you get your podcasts. As I was reading, there was a sentence in the book's introduction that stuck out to me as a possible thesis for the book. after mentioning that we have a set of intense expectations that we place on our romantic relationships, you write, quote, "While we weaken friendships by expecting too little of them, we undermine romantic relationships by expecting too much of them." Help us understand this idea.
Well, if we don't have a term like platonic partners, we don't recognize that friendships can be the relationship that we build our lives around, that, you know, the person that we maybe have a kid with, or is an additional parent in our family that we construct, or would be the person who takes us to chemotherapy if we have cancer, plenty of cases of that, or will be by our side in old age, then we kind of neglect to invest in them in the way that we would if we understood that a friendship can be that significant. I would guess that most people who are listening to this have had some experience with a friend entering a romantic partnership and then the friendship kind of fades because the person is so wrapped up in the romantic relationship and assumes that that's the most important relationship and neglects the other relationships in their lives, or specifically the friendships, and that's not really considered a big deal because the romantic relationship is supposed to be the one you prioritize. So there are all these ways that we either don't actively invest in friendship or kind of assume that friendships will be there when we come back to them and that we don't have to nurture them. Like, we don't have couples therapy for friendships if people are having a hard time. There aren't that many books that can help you navigate conflict or difficulties with friendships. You know, one person I spoke to said that he was raised with the idea that if you're trying in a friendship, then you're working too hard. Like, you shouldn't even be really thinking actively about friendship. Uh-huh. So that's how we weaken friendships. And the flip side to this is that I think we undermine romantic relationships by putting everything on them. Like, I keep thinking of this Michael Bublé song where he says, "You are my everything." And that's supposed to be very romantic, as opposed to a little bit concerning that one person is going to be your soulmate and your roommate and your best friend and your, you know,
co-parent,
and that we celebrate people saying that their romantic partner is their best friend or their everything and so on. And I am not the first person to talk about how putting so much weight on a romantic relationship can make it more vulnerable. Even before I heard Esther Perel talking about this, like, I witnessed this in my own family. I saw a relative of mine in a very long-term relationship when I was still growing up. And when that relationship ended, he'd put everything into that one person. She was his best friend and, you know, the person he went to for everything. And he didn't really have anybody left when that relationship ended. And I don't know if that's why the relationship ended, but it certainly seemed like it was very risky to put all of that on one person. So if we maybe distributed things a little bit more, including to the platonic relationships in our lives, it would leave more space for romantic relationships to breathe.
I mean, I think about all of the ways that I was socialized. I mean, I grew up in a family where I don't even know that I saw my mom. I grew up with a mom and a stepdad. I don't think I ever really even saw her do girls' nights. I certainly did not see her do girls' weekends. I mean, she really was a wife and a mom and a wife and a mom and a worker. I mean, so those were really the three pillars of her life, was motherhood, her marriage, and then her work. And I really didn't see her kind of center women's friendship, you know, in her life. I think probably a lot of us, I think that'd be a really interesting kind of line of self-inquiry for people who are listening. Like, how did you see your parents navigate friendships as you were growing up? And certainly I have centered friendship much more than my mom did, but I didn't, you know, as I was getting married to my husband, you know, my best friendship with Allie predates my marriage to Todd, even knowing Todd. And it wasn't really a conversation of how do you and I, Todd, create a life where I also am near Allie. You know, I love being near Allie. I love the idea of, you know, breakfast together. I mean, we're really great about traveling back and forth to see each other. But had that choice even been on the menu, I wonder what that would have looked like. You know, I don't even know that I would have conceptualized that building an adult life means also figuring out how to ensure that I have easy and steady access to this friendship, besides really always feeling authorized to traveling to see her or having her come see me and, like, kind of tagging out a family responsibility. So certainly I have, like, moved the ball down the field from what I saw growing up. But it's exciting to think about what choices open up when we start to look at that problem of expecting too little from friendships and too much from romantic partnerships.
And I think there's a lot more capacity for people to imagine and to figure out from a starting point, like the conversation I had with my husband, like, what brings you life? Like, who are the people that you most enjoy being around, or what are the activities that matter most to you, instead of kind of being an autopilot and taking basically the cookie cutter option that might work for you and could be extremely meaningful. And I know people that it is exactly the thing that they want, but I think it is not always the thing that people want, and that they, you know, end up not being near the people who mean most to them, but that is considered a sacrifice that is par for the course.
Right. And expected.
Yeah. And that it is just not what you do. You know, if you're choosing between jobs, you consult your romantic partner if you have one. You don't, you know, make a decision about where to work based on your friends. That is very much the norm. And I think people have the potential to both deepen relationships and kind of be more satisfied in their lives holistically if they had an ability to choose more than one option.
That's what's really clear in your book. You aren't pushing this as a better. You're not offering a kind of a hierarchy that people who build lives around platonic friendships are somehow better, but you are, it's like a little alarm clock. The way you describe it is that it's a case study in resisting defaults, which I think is so, I mean, that's what reimagining love is all about, right? Like finding these case studies for how do we resist defaults and how do we wake up from the sort of autopilot? And you use the image, I think it came from one of your interviewees, of the trellis, that we sort of build our lives along this trellis. It's super easy to kind of follow the trellis. And as you're saying, for many of us, it works beautifully. And if you know there's a trellis, then you either joyfully build around the expectations, or you can start to then figure out how you step away and grow towards something else. But you can't do any of that until you're shown or offered alternatives.
And also know that there's a trellis there. I mean,
and know that there's even a trellis.
The beautiful analogy that came from this person I interviewed, Art Pereira, was, you know, he's a plant guy, has dozens of plants. And he was saying that ivying plants, if they have a trellis, they'll grow in the direction of the trellis. But if they don't have a trellis, they'll grow toward the light. So I think part of the hope of the book is that it can help people at least ask for themselves, like, where is the light? And what would it mean to move in that direction?
Okay. I have not yet asked you to give us your working definition of platonic partnerships. Like, how do you define platonic partnerships? Like, what did you discover as sort of the menu of options that people are bundling or bringing into their architecture of these platonic partnerships?
A platonic partnership is really a friendship that is committed, and where the people in this friendship are there for both kind of the mundane parts of life and bigger life events. So in essence, this is not sort of fundamentally different from how, you know, your image of a romantic partner. You just don't really have the sex component of it. But these are friends who live together, who raise children together, who have been by each other's bedside as the other person is dying, who have legal rights to one another, this kind of full gamut of making decisions together and also imagining and acting on a shared future together.
You talk about some significant socio-demographic shifts that have happened in a pretty condensed amount of time, which is the increased age of entry into marriage, as well as the shrinking number of people who are married. And I have noticed this for sure in my work over a couple of decades, is that what happens is that the friend group and social group ends up filling in some of those spaces, which I think is why it's even more important, the work that you're doing of legitimizing these relationships, like really, really legitimizing the power of friendship and the place of friendship, because of the kind of decentering of marriage, and marriage being, as Andrew Turling calls it, the capstone rather than the cornerstone of somebody's adult life. The other thing I was thinking about as a shift that I think supports everything you're offering us here is the increase in the number of people who are estranged from somebody and their family of origin. There's a recent study that came out in the Journal of Marriage and Family that found that potentially as many as 1 in 4 Americans is experiencing estrangement from a parent. And that's more common today than it was before. So if we're less bound by duty and tradition, duty to marriage, tradition of marriage, duty to family of origin, it does free up emotional bandwidth to develop in more enduring friendships that can fill that space. So how are you thinking about the changing role of family of origin and family dynamics?
I mean, I think the queer community offers a lot of kind of precedent for this. I mean, this is where the term that I think is now relatively popular of chosen family comes from. It's from a community where so many people have been abandoned by their families of origin, that they were rejected because their parents disapproved of them. And instead of existing without a family, they found ways to forge their own. So, you know, I think that the queer community really shows us the ways that people will find the support that they need, regardless of the ties that they were handed by chance. And, you know, I certainly thought about the marriage piece. I hadn't thought so much about the estrangement part. And it makes total sense to me, as you're saying, that people need deep support. They need people who they feel will be there no matter what. And if you're not going to get that from the people who raised you, and, you know, if you're not finding a form of that in the realm of romance, then it makes total sense that you are going to invest in another place where you can get this kind of connection and has been really hidden in plain sight. But it's often the people who have no choice but to get imaginative who are kind of the forerunners. They are the pioneers who are showing us what it looks like to build more kinds of ties and in different ways than is the norm for people who maybe didn't have to think about, you know, where else could they be getting that close connection from?
Yeah, I think at best, if and as platonic partnerships become, like if we become less apologetic for our craving of friendship, deeper friendship, more centered friendship, if we become less apologetic for that, if we continue to have models for what it looks like to really center friendship in your life, maybe then it doesn't have to just be like the antidote to estrangement, but it sort of like opens up like, listen, mom and dad, I have this really rich and full life that is built on choice, that is built on shared values, that is built on emotional labor and giving and taking emotional labor. And so therefore I can't do relationships where it's just purely based on tradition and blood. So come with me, let's kind of evolve our relationship. I think that's oftentimes when young people are cutting off or threatening to cut off or pulling away from family of origin, it's sort of like, listen, I need something to keep my attention here more than just I'm your kid and therefore duty, obligation, don't question anything. Like I need this relationship to evolve and to be something that is more mutual, more psychologically rich, more based on support, validation, back and forth.
Which is a hard turn to make. I mean, I certainly know, especially friends coming from immigrant households, like that is a really hard pivot to encourage parents to have. But an interesting thing here is that in some of the most traditional settings, in places where people's marriages are more practical and transactional, like an arranged marriages, especially, at least, you know, I have heard from friends whose parents have arranged marriages that female friendships are so important because the expectation is not necessarily that your husband is going to be your confidant, but that you're going to find that in your friends. And you see versions of this in sort of sex segregated societies where there is a lot of closeness that happens within friendships because there isn't this all-encompassing, you're my everything ideal around marriage. So that's different from the parent-child relationship and what the expectations look like there. But maybe there is some opportunity to get a parent to understand why a non-blood tie would be important, or like, you know, certainly the idea of like aunties and uncles who are not blood related is something that's very common in a lot of communities. And so there might be ways to have those sorts of conversations, but I don't want to say that it's easy.
No. Okay, something else that you bumped up against or noticed coming up in your research was that people in these platonic partnerships often had folks around them either assuming that they were compensating for a lack of a romantic relationship, or assuming that perhaps this relationship really was a romantic relationship, but in hiding. So why do you think people are so eager to assume that these kinds of powerful friendships are somehow connected to romantic love?
Right now, we tie two things together that have not always historically been tied together, which are love and lust. So I think it is really hard for people to understand how someone can be so enamored with another person or want to be committed to them when they don't want to have sex with them. We're taught that if you are excited about a person and you want to commit to them, then like that comes hand in hand with romantic or sexual desire. So this is along the lines of your question around why don't we have a name for this? It's like this, it's just very circular. We you know, the fact that we don't have a concept for love without lust makes it really hard for people to understand these sorts of friendships, which in turn like makes them not even realize they're happening. And then it's easy to deny them. So I think that's kind of part of the dynamic. I do think that there, you know, in some corners, there's like a well-meaning desire to do the opposite of straight washing, to not assume, you know, something that has historically happened to same-sex couples is that people will use euphemisms to describe the couple and say, oh, it's, you know, her good friend or what, and not actually say that these people are romantic partners. So I think in some cases, there's a way of trying to not kind of repeat the ills of the past. I mean, I was just talking to somebody who went to Wellesley, a women's college, and said there it was so open about like queerness that it was hard for anyone to believe that people were friends. You were just always assumed to be girlfriends. So I think that's, you know, in some ways like an admirable way to correct, but it might be an overcorrection. So I think that's one thing. But I do feel like fundamentally, it's just really hard for people to understand that you could be absolutely adoring of another person and not want to sleep with them. We really put so much emphasis on sex in our culture.
You write so beautifully about the distinction between sexual energy and erotic energy. And so much of what we feel in a friendship, not just even in the early days of friendship, but throughout friendship, is that erotic energy, an erotic connection, which just means the kind of spirit of aliveness, the giddiness, the playful back and forth of energy or experience or banter that can feel even confusing for the person experiencing it. And then perhaps also, as you're saying, confusing for a well-meaning outsider who's like, if you're this charged up about this friendship, maybe you actually do want to be sexual with them. And it really isn't. It's because we maybe misunderstand and don't quite know how to work with our own erotic energy, just the aliveness of powerful connection and playful connection that we kind of are missing a rich vocabulary and more nuanced understanding of those experiences inside of ourselves.
Yeah, I think we just collapse things together that can go together, but they don't always have to, and maybe missing the many kinds of situations where you might have that kind of erotic charge. Like when I was reading descriptions of eroticism, like one coming from Audre Lorde that did have to deal with this aliveness, I was like, oh, that is exactly how I feel with M. It's like a more energized, more awakened version of myself, which like does not really have to do with sex. You know, it's something else about feeling more realized, I think, as a person, which sex can or cannot do. So I think it's noticing that it is often happening in one situation, but that is not the exclusive situation in which that kind of feeling can arise, is one of the reasons that people don't recognize it. And I think it's frankly sad. And we have a lot of opportunity to feel that kind of deeper connection than we've been told. We're told it can only exist in this one kind of relationship, but there are other ways to find it.
It's just so darn validating. I have said for years that when I spend time with my really close, dear, lifelong girlfriends, like I can't wait for my first day of therapy sessions, like after a girls' weekend, because I'm more alive as a therapist. I can't wait for like that week with my husband or with my kids. Like I'm my favorite version of me, my most awakened relational version of me. It's like a recharging, like going back to the mothership and recharging my source. It's such a vital source of connection. I don't think that we're taught to, at least I don't think I was taught to see that like in bountiful, pluralistic ways. You know, it sort of is like, do I need that because of a deficit over here, right? Can feel powerful connections elsewhere, can feel like a threat to a primary connection.
I just think the math doesn't work that way. Like,
that's right.
That we assume these things are zero sum as opposed to like you have a relationship that thrills you in one area of life. I mean, in theory, if you have a romantic relationship that's like dull and not that great, then maybe having this shiny friendship over here is going to really draw out the contrast. But if you have like a very good romantic relationship and you have a wonderful friendship that you will probably come to your partner more alive. Or, you know, I heard again and again the way that these friendships enrich romantic relationships, that people feel like they are a better version of themselves, that they are not kind of dependent on one person, their romantic partner, for everything, that they have somebody to go to as a first stop and to work things out with and figure out what they're going to say to their partner or resolve something that's hard for them, and that makes the relationship better. Or that, you know, I've been in situations where, like, I've been telling my husband, like, let's go, we have different kinds of hobbies. And sometimes it takes another person in our life to make us excited about something that the other person, our partner already cares about. And we sort of get a new infusion of interest in something that, you know, we didn't take it seriously because we've been together for a long time. So I think there are all sorts of small and large ways that these relationships absolutely don't subtract from each other, but really can, like, multiply the kind of excitement that people feel.
Okay, well, you know, I'm not going to let you get out of here without spending some time asking you to offer guidance. Like, where do we go from here? One of the keys, I think, comes from the first friendship that you introduce us to in the book, which is Andrew and Tolly. Is that how you say his name?
Yep.
At one point in the conversation with them, Andrew says, "Our commitment was almost born out of how we acted in moments where it could have fallen away." So what are some of those moments when a friendship could fall away? And what have you learned from your research about how we keep our friendship strong in those moments when it could fall away?
I think big moments of transition are real likely places where friendships can fall away. So moving, entering, or, you know, committing to a romantic relationship. And some of these things can go together, like people enter a romantic relationship and then leave their friend. I'm thinking of the TV show Friends, where Monica makes her best friend move out of the apartment so that her fiance could move in. When people have children and have to deal with gulfs in both the experience of being a parent or not a parent, but, you know, I've seen in my own life how people really prioritize sort of privacy and control, and that can take them physically further away from their friends. And I think any kinds of challenges where it would help to have open conversation to navigate those. So, which I think gets to, like, what do you do about it? Well, I think one is not treating friendship as a relationship where everything goes unsaid, and to use a lot of the same kinds of tools and approaches that we apply to romantic relationships. Certainly people who listen to this podcast who are going to be particularly intentional about their romantic relationships, to have conversations when, you know, if you're thinking about moving, even like talking to a friend about how you realize it might be hard for them, or are you missing something about, like, I want us to be really important in each other's lives, and how, like, are there ways that we can do that? Something that I've heard so much is that people want to have their friends play a larger role in their lives than they think their friends want. And given that so many people are thinking about this, I think that if people were open, they might realize that they actually have some of the same desires, but they're afraid of rejection, looking silly, looking desperate. So it doesn't occur to them to talk about, like, what would it look like for us to buy a home together, or, you know, any number of other things. So, you know, I think for many of these cases, it's really about being courageous enough to share what you actually want. And when you're feeling hurt, or when you don't understand something that's happening, I've had to learn that myself, and treat the relationship like you would treat any other serious, significant relationship in your life.
I love that point about vulnerability and risk-taking. And you describe friendship and romantic relationship in the book as these twins where there's, like, a lot to learn from the other. And it's making me think about commitment sequences and commitment milestones. And certainly for cis hetero people, there's a comfort in the scripts. We know who's supposed to ask whom for the next step. We know roughly how a relationship moves from dating to commitment to engagement to marriage. We don't have those kinds of, like, commitment sequences for friendship, and it's not clear which of us is going to pipe up first around, I want more closeness, or would you ever want to consider moving into similar cities or moving near each other or buying a home together? There's no script we can follow. And so really all we can do is anchor in on our vulnerability and this message that you're offering, like, hey, you guys, I talked to a bunch of people and here's what I heard. Everyone is kind of curious. Like the chances that your friend is also curious about how to become a little more committed, how to become a little more intertwined or interdependent are pretty strong. They may also be thinking about this, but not also having any idea how to bring it up. So maybe just be the one who's brave.
This is bringing me back to a conversation I had years ago with friends. And we were all sitting on a couch together as three of us. And I was like, do you want more physical affection in your friendships? And all of us were like, yes. And then I was like, would you be willing to initiate physical affection in your friendships? And we, like the others said no. And I was like, well, that seems like a problem. And we're all just like, they're stiff. Right. And so, you know, if no one's willing to make the first move, yeah, there might be a chance if you make the first move that you're not going to be met with what exactly you want. People want different things, but you also might end up not getting something that everybody wants, but no one is willing to kind of take the leap.
Beautiful. Okay. Last little scenario is, what about when there's a romantic couple and partner A is experiencing some feelings of criticism or judgment of partner B's friends and is sort of seeing them as a threat or just is kind of holding them in disdain? What are some of the suggestions you may have for how partner A can navigate those feelings of judgment and criticism or what they can do as a couple?
That's rough for people who have to go through that. And I think yeah, I mean, this is a place where I'm like, I'm not a therapist here. So maybe you have good ideas about this. But, you know, my instinct is like, can you figure out what the root of the concern is? Is it that, you know, your partner is genuinely concerned about your friends and that maybe, you know, you hadn't seen that they were influencing you in a way that is not so great? Or is it about a sense of insecurity that the romantic partner has? And in order to manage that insecurity, that person is trying to reduce the influence of the friendships. Like those are very different kinds of motivations. And I think it is hard sometimes when you are in the thick of a relationship, whether it's a friendship that you really love or a romantic relationship, to see people's true intentions or to see people for who they are. But, you know, one of the reasons that I'm so committed to narrative journalism and I go deep into people's stories in the book is because I think in the particular and in the details of people's lives, we can see ourselves. And I think, you know, to the extent it's possible to read the stories of people who are navigating both friendships and romantic relationships and to see the different ways that people react and like what feels kind of resonant with your experience and what doesn't so much. And are there things that you're not seeing? Are there ways that, you know, maybe the partner has motives that aren't so great? Like I write about a woman whose romantic partner was just extraordinarily possessive. And he denigrated her best friend, not because the best friend was at all a bad influence, but because he wanted to control her. And, you know, that's a very different thing from like your friend is actually a bad influence.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, that's right. It really does. It lives in the particulars. And I can just imagine, I know these situations where there becomes a triangle, right? Of like you, your romantic partner, and your best friend. And to be in the middle of that triangle is really challenging. I think there are times when if that person who's the kind of the fulcrum can kind of pull back and have their best friend and their romantic partner kind of get to know each other better and on their own terms. I think sometimes what happens is if I sense tension between my partner and my friend, I want to run more interference and I want to make sure I'm the center of the dynamic and I'm trying to help them love each other more. And that can kind of fuel tensions. And so the thing that may feel paradoxical to do is to pull back and sort of have your partner and your best friend see if they can kind of find some common ground together. They have an easy common ground. They both love you, you know? And then obviously, like for everyone in the dynamic to kind of take a peek at what's getting replayed from the past. I think it's another thing that we miss an opportunity to do when we devalue friendships is we miss the chance to see how in our friendships, we also replay old family dramas, old sibling competition, old questions about worth, old questions around, do you see me? Do you respect me? Like all of that kind of old unhealed wound stuff we bring into our friendships. But if we don't elevate them and hold them with the deep value that they have, then we miss the opportunity to do that healing work within our friendships.
you know, I think this goes back to like, if you see a relationship as significant, it doesn't just mean that you're going to kind of commit more to it, but it also means that you take the conflict seriously and you treat them as relationships that are worth trying to unpack and understand, and that might cause pain that will show up in future relationships, that it's not trivial, which I think is the way that a lot of people see friendships now, not just trivial in the sense that they shouldn't matter that much, but also that like, while you have a loss in a friendship, you had a falling out or a friend died, it's just a friend. Like that friends can, you know, inspire the same deep and broad set of emotions that our familial and our romantic relationships can also bring out in us.
I love that part of the book where you said that there was a somebody going through a friendship breakup and he really struggled because he couldn't find music to soothe him the way that he could have found music to kind of speak to his pain if it would have been a romantic relationship breakup. And there's such a, that's so striking to look at the absence of representation of friendships in our art, in our music. And the reason we need those stories or we need those lyrics is exactly what you're saying, because they validate our experiences. They make real. They reflect back to us how we know. We know darn well that friendship breakups hurt like hell. But when there's not music to turn to or story to turn to or art to turn to, it can feel really invalidating.
Mm-hmm. Well, one little addendum post having written the book is that a couple of my friends who have a history of writing songs about romantic love wrote a song based on the book, and that's called Dear Friend, and it is so good.
That's so cool. Can we link it in the show notes?
Oh, totally. Yeah. It's turned into this whole great project where, so my friends wrote this, and then like at a couple of my events, they'll be going to be playing it, including on the drums will be somebody I mentioned on the first page of the book. And we have another friend who's a professional producer who's going to produce it, and other friends singing backup. So it's turned into this whole project of friends making a song about friendship, and as a partly a way to kind of correct for the absence of songs about friendship. I think we have some, you know, TV shows that show us with like Grace and Frankie and the Golden Girls and so on, that friendship can be close, but really in music, there's so little. Like Carole King is still holding it for us like decades later when you've got a friend. Like we need some more.
I mean, how cool that your book is already inspiring art. Like you did your part of creating this book, which is heady and heartfelt and soulful. And now you put it out in the world and you just get to see and not see, because a lot of this stuff will happen. You won't even ever know that it happened. You won't ever know how this book inspires or changes somebody else's life. But what a beautiful thing that it already is becoming a muse for new music that never had existed before. And now there's this song, Dear Friend. How cool.
And ultimately goes back to the people who I interviewed who opened their lives to me, you know?
Yes. Thank you to all the people who sat with Raina and shared their stories. Thank you. Thank you for doing that. Yeah. Well, Raina, it's been so fun to talk to you. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for the deep questions about friendship and really digging into the book. It was really a pleasure.
So we will have links to the show notes for where you can get Raina's brand new book, The Other Significant Others. How else can people connect with you and learn more about what you're doing?
So my first name is spelled pretty unusually, so I'm pretty easy to find on the interwebs. My first name is spelled R-H-A-I-N-A. So like I'm Raina.substack. My Instagram and Twitter and so on are at my first name and last name, Raina Cohen. So, you know, you can follow the work that I'm doing on Social Connection. And I also do all sorts of work on different kinds of narrative stories for NPR.
Wonderful. Thank you, Raina. Thank you, Raina, for joining me here on Reimagining Love. You can find a link to The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center, in this episode's show notes. If you enjoy this episode, I challenge you to share it with a friend and open up a conversation that explores and celebrates the possibilities in your friendship. And until next time, be well. Reimagining Love is produced and edited by Emily Reeves. Our theme music was composed by Slade Warnkin. Do you have a relationship question that you want answered on the show? Visit reimagininglove.com to send in a written or audio question. Questions can be about intimate partnerships, family relationships, friendships, you name it. If you're looking for more love and relationship content, you can find me on Instagram at dr.alexandra.solomon or visit my website, dralexandrasolomon.com, where you'll find my blog as well as the Intimate Relationships 101 e-course based off of the popular class I teach at Northwestern University. Thank you for listening and see you next week here on Reimagining Love.